Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Scottsdale Big Book Study, where we will study the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Maria F., and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from County Dublin in Ireland, and I will be your host for today's study. Our co-hosts today are Tanya G., Dottie S. is going to do Q&A, and also Johan N. will be co-hosting with us here today. If you have any questions or concerns during today's meeting, please contact either myself or any of the co-hosts, and you can do this by private message in the chat function. We will disable the chat for the duration of the study and open it up again at 10 minutes before the Q&A. Please note that our speaker, Harlan G, will be recorded for the duration of today's study. However, the Q&A session which follows, we don't record that. We'll put a link in for the previous week's recordings in the chat function, and also a link for the Seven Tradition payment. We ask that if you could please make sure to keep your microphone on mute at all times during today's study, and also please turn off your video if you're exercising, driving, you're eating, or if you need to step away from your screen for any reason, please just disconnect your camera while you do that. We ask that you refrain from making use of the chat function, even to message other attendees privately. And now we are going to turn over the meeting to Harlan G. in Scottsdale, Arizona. Good morning, Harlan.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you very much. It is an astounding day here in Arizona. It's going to be in the low 90s today, and there's not a cloud in sight, and the humidity is very low. I hope it's as stunning a day wherever you are, whatever you're doing, as it is here in Arizona today. So glad to be here. We have been talking about the chapter, There Is a Solution. And without going a long way, I'm just going to touch base on this. There is a solution. What a gift to the world God gave, because for thousands and thousands of years, there was no solution. And people who misunderstood us would tell us things like, oh, you just need some willpower. Oh, just don't drink so much. Oh, just push yourself away from the table. Oh, just eat half, or whatever it is that they would tell us was coming from a place, well-intentioned as it was or is, but ignorant. Not because they're bad people, not because they're not intelligent people, but they don't know. They don't understand what it is that we are. I know they don't understand what we do, but they also don't understand what we are. And what we are people who have an illness. And this chapter does say it's an illness, and it's an illness of this sort. It's an illness of the mind and an illness of the body. And that we are compelled to eat the way we eat against our will because of the intense pain that is suffered by us from not eating. Because when fear, anger, happiness, lust, jealousy, any of these emotions, glee, when any of these emotions build up, our brain is exceedingly uncomfortable with the reality that it perceives around us. And what you cannot convince anyone of who doesn't suffer from this disease is that an Almond Joy bar will instantly and effectively change my perception of reality. It changes my perception of reality so effectively. And I use that word effectively deliberately because this effect of that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly from eating that food is what we will chase to the gates of hell and death and elimination from life and isolation. We will chase that effect all of our lives, unless we have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. And we also have something else. See, if all that was the problem was this perception of reality that I could change instantly by eating M&Ms with peanuts, of course. I don't know who buys those other M&Ms. Obviously, these are not Jewish people. The M&M, if I'm going to spend my nickel, I want the damn peanut in there. I don't want plain. I want peanut. Okay. Call me crazy. I want the peanut in there. Okay. Now, Bottom line is, if all that was wrong with me was that I had this perception of reality that made me very uncomfortable, I could take like a Batman utility belt or a fanny pack or maybe like a little change purse, and I could keep M&Ms in there because they melt in your mouth, not in your hand. I could keep some M&Ms in there, and every time I got upset, I could pop an M&M and it would be like a Xanax or it'd be like a whatever, and then I would just feel better and I could go on with my day, bim boom bop, and we're ready to go. But that's only half the problem. The other half of the problem is in my body, and that body part, or not that body part, that body part that is the problem is the physical allergy, the craving. See, I've never eaten one piece of pizza or one M&M or one Dorito or one bagel in my entire life. When I eat one, I'll eat every one of them that I can get my hands on. And the only time I ever ate one piece of pizza was when it was the last piece I could get my hands on. And if you're relating to me and what I'm saying, then welcome home. Welcome to Overeaters Anonymous. Welcome home. But this chapter gives us some tremendous hope. There is a solution. This was also the first chapter written. Now, I want to point out something before I forget. Today is April 13th, and if you were listening on the 10th of April, which is 3 days ago, I think every one of us on this line right now, and there's over 100 of us, we need to bow our heads in thanks. Because on April the 10th, 1935, on April, excuse me, April the 10th, 1939, 85 years ago, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous came off the presses. For 85 years, there has been light and warmth in the freezing cold cave of addiction. And that this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, when it first came off the presses on April the 10th, 1935, was the very first time in human recorded history where there was a book by alcoholics for alcoholics that gave a codified, specific method of going from addiction to recovery. So to celebrate that there is a solution is to also celebrate the multitude of miracles that God brought upon the earth. I don't want to sound biblical, but I don't have any other way of describing it. See, it wasn't a miracle that we have this book. It was the culmination of many, many miracles going back to Dr. Jung and Roland and Sebra Graves Jr. and Sebra Graves Sr. and Ebby and Hank and Lois and Bill and Silkworth. There's lots of people, lots of miracles that went into the formation of this very, very special event in the world. And that this book, unchanged, will live 20,000 generations into the future to save the lives of our unborn great, 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 whatever grandchildren in the future. And this book has restored more alcoholics, drug addicts, gamblers, compulsive overeaters, sex addicts, love addicts, gamblers, drug addicts, you name it, alcoholics, you name it, has restored more addicts back to society than all other methods combined. All other methods combined. So I ask you to do something for me today. At some point today, bow your head and thank whatever God you pray to. Thank whatever God you believe in that you are the recipient of all these miracles in the form of the book and the fellowship that sprang from it. Something to be grateful for today. Every day in the evening, I ask myself, what am I grateful for? I name three things at least. And then what did I see today that was beautiful? And that's something to think about. There is a solution. There is a solution. I don't have to go searching for the right one. I don't have to go searching for the best one. I don't have to go searching for whatever. I have the solution in my hands when I pick up this book. And when we go through this chapter, we come upon the line on page 19 that we read last week. And it says on page 19, by the way, we're going to start on page 21. We're going to start on page 21, and the words we're going to start with in just a few minutes are, but what about the real alcoholic? But as is my wont, we're going to lead into it. So on page 19, it says, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. And what I see in this fellowship for so long, almost half a century, what I see, and I've done it, are people who come in, they lose their weight, or they get some abstinence and they're still a little overweight or a lot overweight, and they feel like they've got it. And so they leave. We feel that elimination of alcohol is but a beginning, of drinking is but a beginning, means that we have to work the steps and we have to work them every day for the rest of our lives. And if we don't, it's just a matter of when are we going to go back into the food? And if there's anything I could tell you on being a better sponsor, it's to keep reinforcing to people, not maybe every day, but at least once a week, that this disease kills. And it kills absolutely. And it doesn't just kill you dead. It kills your life. It snuffs out whatever life you could have had. Let's talk turkey here for just a minute, guys. We're all going to die. Nobody's going to get out of here scot-free. We're all going to die. We're all going to die. It's, did I live while I was here? Did I live my life to the fullest while I was on this earth? And I don't know a way to do that if I'm in the food. Yes, I've had some good times eating, and I'm not eating, but you know, while I was eating, I had some good times. I had some memorable times, but there's no real happiness when I'm in the food. There's no real joy in my heart when I'm in the food. There isn't. Because I hate myself when I'm in the food, and I hate God. And if I hate myself and I hate God, and I'm uncomfortable in my skin, and I'm uncomfortable in my world, and I'm uncomfortable with other people, and I'm uncomfortable being seen in public, and I'm uncomfortable with the way I think and the things I do, then there is no real joy in my life. There really isn't. And as a sponsor, I feel it's very important to remind sponsees that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning, that a much more important demonstration of these principles. What are the principles? The principles are the steps lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs, that I must practice these steps in everything that I do. Very important. And it also tells me on page 20 that it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. In another part of the book, in the thesis line of the book, page 45, it's going to tell me that the main object of this book is to help me find a power greater than myself. So if the main object of the book is to help me find a power greater than myself, and on page 20, it says, it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. Is that consistent? Yes. Yes. Because if I listen and obey the instructions in the book, I will find a higher power. And in the introduction or the foreword to the very first edition of this book, it is going to tell me, on the second sentence, I believe, it says, to show, that's on page XIII in the fourth edition, XIII is 13 in Roman numerals. It says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Is that consistent? Yes. Notice it doesn't say to tell other alcoholics how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. It is to show, to demonstrate rather than tell. And once again, the miracle of Dr. Howard in Montclair, New Jersey. In Montclair, New Jersey, was a psychiatrist named Dr. Howard, and he went to Bill after seeing a mimeographed copy of the book. He went to Bill and said, you need to make changes, and you need to change passages of this book from the imperative to the declarative. What is an imperative? What is a declarative? The imperative is you do this and you do that. You say this and you say that. And Bill was convinced by Dr. Howard that alcoholics are not going to respond to that. Bill knew at the end of his life that we are immature, sensitive, perfectionistic rebels, and we don't like being told what to do. So if you notice, everything that can be is in the declarative. In other words, it's past tense. These are the steps we took. These are the things we did. These are the things we found. It's all past tense. And that makes it more palatable. It's as if they're sharing with you because that's exactly what they're doing. They're sharing with you. So this is very, very important. Let's go to page 21. But what about the real alcoholic? Because we've been talking about the moderate drinker, and we've been talking about, you know, and the real alcoholic, he may start off as a moderate drinker. You know, I have friends of mine who did some drinking when they were in their 20s. They would go to singles bars and they would drink, and some of them did some drugs. Some of them did whatever they did. And then all of a sudden, one day, they realized that this has to stop. And they stopped. They just stopped. I couldn't do that. I realized when I was four that my eating, my consumption of candy, of chocolate, of corned beef, of pastrami, of salami, pizza, my consumption of these things was driving me and the people around me batty, crazy. And the doctors would scream at the top of their lungs at my parents. I didn't want to be eating these things. I couldn't help it. And when you tell people that, oh, you could help it if you had willpower. I didn't have any willpower then. And I have no willpower now because there was a fire going on inside of me that had to be put out. And the only way to put that fire out was with food, certain foods. And I couldn't live with that fire burning inside me. And I threw caution to the wind and said, screw it. If I have to die, I'll die. But I can't live without this, and I can't live without that. So the bottom line to this day is I am a real compulsive overeater. I am absolutely a real compulsive overeater. He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Why is that? That's because of the physical allergy. The mental twist drives him into the first drink, the physical allergy takes over, and they end up drunk. They end up drinking more than they had planned to. We talked about that ad nauseum in the doctor's opinion and in Bill's story. Remember the part where Bill goes into the bar to make a phone call? Now he finds himself pounding on the bar, asking himself how this happened. But as the whiskey rose to my head, he says, "I might as well get good and drunk this time." And I did, he says, because the mental twist drove him into the first drink. And the physical allergy took over. That's step one information. And this chapter is step one information. Now, here's the longest paragraph in the book. And when we do this paragraph for vision, we split it up, we split it in two. But we're going to try to tackle as much of this paragraph as we can. And if we finish, we finish. And if we don't, we don't. Page 21, middle of the page, longest paragraph in the book. Here's the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Let's stop right there for just a second. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was a very scary kind of book. It's a scary kind of monster movie. And when I was a little boy, I grew up in Chicago. And on Saturday night, they had something in Chicago called Creature Features. It was on Channel 32. And they'd have a guy named Sven Gulli who would host Creature Features. And you'd tune in on Saturday night and they'd have the mummy and Frankenstein and Dracula. And oh, they'd have all kinds of scary movies. Now, I'll let you in on a little secret. When I was a little kid, I was watching The Wizard of Oz. Those monkeys scared me to death. I couldn't sleep for days after those crazy monkeys. And I'm one of the only people I know. I don't want to watch The Wizard of Oz because I'm 69 years old. I'll be 70 in about 15 minutes. And you know what? I still don't like those monkeys. They still scare the crap out of me. And I don't like at least that part of it. And the witch's voice drives me crazy. But anyway, Robert Louis Stevenson had written lots of adventure books and books for children, and he comes up with this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, his wife found the manuscript. She burned it. She waited until he left the house and she burned it and said, "Robert, how in the world have you written something so dreadfully ghastly? How in the world, where in your brain did you come up with something?" Now, I'm going to tell you something. Robert Louis Stevenson's father was an alcoholic. And when he was sober, he was wonderful. But when he was drunk, he was a monster. Now, let's take a look at Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for just a minute. You don't have to go read the book, nor do you have to go watch Creature Features on Channel 32 in Chicago, which is now WFLD. It used to be something else back then. I can't think of what it was. But anyway, you don't have to. I'll tell you what the story is. It's the story of a man who drinks a potion and becomes a mean monster. And when Robert Louis Stevenson's father would drink liquor, he became abusive to his wife. He became abusive to his children. He became abusive to anyone in his environment. Where indeed did Robert Louis Stevenson come up with a story about a nice guy who drinks a potion and becomes a monster from his own life? That's where he got that idea. He got it from his own life. Let's continue. But oh wait, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is appropriate because when I'm eating and I'm deep in, I don't mean when I'm eating my abstinent dinner or my abstinent breakfast, I don't mean that. But when I'm in the food, I am a very different person, not somebody you want to be around. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. Why is that? Because of the physical allergy. He just can't stop. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day, and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. When I'm in the food, I don't want to be seen by anybody. I don't want to see anybody. I'm afraid of what they're going to say to me. I don't know how they're going to comment on my weight gain. I don't know how they're going to embarrass me, but I know that they're going to. And the reason that I don't want to be seen is I've taken enough abuse and it hurts my feelings. And many thousands of times in my life, I had to pretend that people were hurting my feelings and I had to pretend that it didn't bother me. And I'm tired of pretending. I'm tired of pretending that certain things don't hurt me when you pull food off my table and give it to the busboy and say, "You're too fat, you don't need this." When you say to me how fat I am, or you want to feel my ass, or you want to feel my stomach, it bothers me. It makes me feel bad. When you tell me as a doctor that I'm going to die, it scares me and it makes me feel bad. When girls reject me because of my size and I understand, it hurts me. It bothers me. When you tell me as a clerk in a clothing store that you don't have, and I'm in a big and tall store, that you don't have any pants or shirts to fit me, you only go up to size 60, it hurts me. It bothers me. When I can't get in and out of a car and you notice it, it hurts me and it bothers me. I am human just like you. I may have been encased in a blubbery, obese body, but I'm just as human as the next person. And I have feelings and I have emotions and I have some shred of dignity and pride. And I don't want to be hurt like that. Don't point at me and laugh. Don't do that. It hurts. But I couldn't stop children from pointing at me and laughing. I couldn't stop it. That's what kids do. They point out, "Look at Fatso over there." And I was an object of ridicule for a very long time in my life. And it has its effect on people. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. This was the story of my life, although I ate every day. But Bill Wilson tells a story when stocks were at a low point in 1932 and they had formed a group to buy. He was to share generously in the profits, and the chance vanished because of his drinking. How many times did Bill face ruin because of his drinking? Many times, many, many times. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. Here's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet early next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. That is the insanity of alcoholism. We're killing ourselves with food, and yet the next morning we're at it again and again and again and again. And no matter how much humiliation we suffer, no matter how much pain we suffer, no matter how much isolation we may suffer, we will seek out the very thing that caused our pain and eat it yet again? Is there a more intimate relationship in this world than you have with food? You see it and you make it a part of your body. You consume it into your body. What could be more intimate than that? You see this substance that you know is killing you, and you prepare it, you unwrap it, and it becomes a part of your body. Wow, that's intimacy for you. That's intimacy for you. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Sedative and liquor. Wow, that guy is in Twinkle Land. That guy is in Twinkle Land. Wow. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. This is the downside of alcoholism. You're appearing in hospitals and sanitariums, and you're taking sedative and liquor. You're circling the drain at this point. You are circling the drain. How nightmarish is it to watch somebody doing it? And I was watching myself do it. In my 20s, in my late teens, I was circling the drain. Wow, it's just so horrible. Another one of my classmates from high school died yesterday. And I didn't know him very well in high school, but I knew him in grammar school. And he was a nice guy. And it's just so sad when you see it. Because I remember these people as children. So it's just a very sad state of affairs. And I just want to live. I want to live and I want to thrive. I don't have that much more time left. My sponsor hates it when I say that, but I don't. I'm going to be 70 years old here in just 15 minutes or, at the end of May. I just want to live. I want to live to the fullest. I want to enjoy every life. I want to enjoy not every life. I want to enjoy every minute of every day. And I want to live my life to the fullest. Yogi Berra said, it ain't over till it's over. Well, I didn't start out very good, but I want to finish real strong. I want to finish real strong. And I want to give the world the best that I have. I want to give it a book, and I want to give it the podcasts, and I want to give it whatever I can give it. And in return, God always gives me back a million times what I put in, a million times what I put in. And on the last day of my life, when I meet God, I want him to say, I was a little worried about you at first, but you did a good job. And if he can say to me, job well done, then I will know that every piece of crap that I walked through was worth it. I hope that I will get that from God, that it was a job well done and that I did okay. But I want to live right up to the time I die. And I hope I can. I know I can. With God's help, I can. Middle of 22. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. Very important. Why does he behave like this if hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation? Why is it that he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Bill Wilson teaches us on page 7 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that Silkworth taught him that he had been selfish and foolish, but he had been ill bodily and mentally. That means the allergy and the twist of the mind. He had been ill bodily and mentally. Now, this is an illness. When it comes to things like this, this description of this, why can't he use the common sense and willpower that sometimes displays with respect to other matters? I'm reminded of one of my very, very best friends in the whole world, a man I love from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head. He was my best man at my wedding. I was his best man at his wedding. And he and I have been frenemies. The reason I say we're frenemies is he always roots against my sports teams. Whatever team I like, he'll root against that team. So I do the same to him. But he's very mean in that respect. But anyway, he's a brilliant boy, brilliant. And he was a partner and vice president of some of the largest accounting firms in the world. Very highly successful boy. He is brilliant. He passed the CPA exam the first time he took it at age 21. That's something that's extremely rare, to pass all three parts on the first try at such a young age. That is, most CPAs have to take that exam several times before they pass the whole thing. He passed it the first time. He's about 400 pounds. He can't get a handle on this at all. He has common sense. He has discipline and a long track record of success when it comes to other matters. And that's what's working against him, part of what's working against him with this. And we all have those things that we've done in our lives. You know, there's 142 of you here now. And I bet that if I got to know some of you, I'd be amazed at what you could accomplish, if you, what you have accomplished, not could, but have. Some of you have PhDs. Some of you have more than one master's degree. Some of you have college degrees. Some of you have raised families, have engaged in professions, or you've been whatever you've been, and you've done a good job. But I know one thing you can't do. You can't stay out of the food now that you want to. And you can't, another thing you can't do is you can't control the amount you eat once you've started because of an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind. You can't do that. No matter what you've done in your life, you'll never be able to do that unless you have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. There's no chance that a person like me can ever handle this by himself. I will not be able to control and enjoy my food while I'm eating it. If I control it, I can't enjoy it. If I enjoy it, I can't control it. It's an illness. This is step one stuff. This chapter is step one. Okay, page 22, toward the bottom. Perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently than normal from normal people. We are not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. This disease is permanent. It never goes away. It is progressive. It keeps getting worse no matter if you're eating or you're not eating. And if it's untreated, it is fatal. But doing worse than kill you, this disease will rob you of whatever life you could have had. And it will isolate you and beat you down. And once it has beat you down, it will set you on fire. And after it sets you on fire, every day it'll pour more gasoline on you to watch you burn. That's this disease. It is a merciless executioner. Bottom of 22, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens in both the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. The allergy and the twist of the mind and the mental blank spot, the built-in forgetter. You forget that this is killing you and that this time it's not okay, and you'll eat the food anyway in search of relief from the intenable pain of not eating. You will search for it and search for it to the gates of insanity or death. I'm at the top of 23. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Now, this next sentence is one of the most important sentences in the book, in the language, in the world. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. Let's read it again and then we'll discuss it. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. Now, remember last week when we read the sentence that we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. And if you are sponsoring, and I hope most of you are, you must, in my opinion, you must convince your sponsees that it is the mind that we are going to work on now, and that it is the mind that we are going to concern ourselves with, because the rest of the steps beyond step one never mention the substance of food. It is never mentioned. And so we have a situation on our hands where it is clearly delineated that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So what are we going to do for that? We're going to take a look at the rest of the steps and see that not one of them mentions food. Not one of them is going to mention food. Beyond step one, food is not mentioned at all, because now we're going to attack the most critical part of the disease, which is the mind. Because I cannot do anything. I just picked up my water and I'm going to take a drink of water. I can't do that without first thinking that I'm going to do that. And so it is with Chunky bars and with Almond Joy bars and pizza and Chips Ahoy cookies and God knows what. So we're going to think about what sets the terrible cycle in motion, and that is the mind. And the way to quiet the mind from wanting the drink is the job that we are going to endeavor to do in the next 11 steps. We're going to clear away guilt and shame and remorse. We're going to clear away regret, fear, anger, selfishness, the preoccupation we have of what people are thinking of us, and the preoccupation that we have of what's going on here, we're going to emancipate ourselves. We're not going to emancipate ourselves. God is going to emancipate us from these concerns through the working of the steps. We're going to get right with God. We're going to get right with ourselves. and then right with our fellow human being. It's going to be a three-prong process. We're going to get right with God. We're going to get right with ourselves. And then we're going to get right with our fellow human beings. And when I like myself, not in a narcissistic way, I know some of you are thinking, I'm pretty great. Yeah, but if you were thinking of it in a healthy way, you wouldn't be here. You'd be out eating normally. But when I like myself and I like God and I help my fellow human being, and I pray and I meditate and I do my steps and I face the music on the things I've done wrong, the desire to eat is simply not there. We are not eliminating food. We are eliminating the desire for the relief from the pain. I'm going to say that two more times. We are not about to eliminate the food. We are going to eliminate the desire to change how we feel. And the food is just a symbol. It's just a symptom. I'm going to say it one more time. We are not about the elimination of the food, although you have to eliminate the foods, yes. We are about changing the way you feel so your mind does not see the need to eat that food. Because you already feel better and you don't need Chips Ahoy or pizza to make you feel better. You already feel better. If you are a sponsor, emphasize this. Emphasize this. It's very, very important that you teach your sponsees what we're doing and why we're doing it so that everything seems to click. And they have to do it whether they understand it or not. It's not about what they understand, it's about what they do. But you can at least try to clearly tell them that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And in the next 11 steps, we are never going to mention the consumption of excess food again, ever. Liquor, food, gambling, love addiction, sex addiction, drug addiction, internet addiction, smoking, whatever that may be, is relievable through the working of these steps. Because you will already feel better and your mind will not focus on the need for these things to make you feel better. Page 23. That sentence, by the way, before we leave it, should be highlighted in your book, on your mind, in your heart. And in your soul, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. We're going to eliminate the desire to eat these foods by making us feel better already without them. Very key. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. I didn't know why I was doing what I was doing. I had no idea. I made up lies to get people off my back, off my case. I didn't know why I was doing it, and I didn't give a damn why. I just knew that if I couldn't live without pizza, I didn't want to live. I didn't want to live. I didn't want to live without Chips Ahoy cookies. I didn't want to live on a Saturday night. I would have my threesome, me, Little Debbie, and Sara Lee. Once in a while, we'd make an orgy out of it. We would invite Ben and Jerry's. Ben and Jerry. Every once in a while, but not all the time. Okay, let's continue. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic drinking bout creates. My life was not just havoc. My life was a whirlwind of embarrassment and loneliness and shame. My life was a life of pain, physical pain, mental pain, loneliness, shame on what I had done to my friends, what I had done to myself. What kind of legacy was I going to leave my mother and father by dying in my 30s of extreme morbid obesity? How was I serving God? I didn't know and I didn't care. I just wanted to be out of pain. I wanted to be dead. The one life that I had, what is it about the human being, the human creature, that takes the one life we have and craps it away for food? It doesn't make any sense, but we do it every day. It doesn't make any sense. This is not a dress rehearsal. This is it. This is it. The lights are on, the orchestra is playing, and the audience is here, and the overture is playing. This is it. This is life. This is it. I don't want to spend my life isolating. I love being a part of life. And there's so much lately that I've tasted of life that I never even knew what I was missing. I never even knew what I was missing because I had never experienced it before. Now that I know what I was missing at a certain level, it makes it even worse. But at a certain level, I just want more and more and more and more. I hope I get to live all day today. I hope I don't die today. I really do. I hope I don't die today. At least not in the next 9 minutes, so I can at least say I finished this. I hope I live at least 9 more minutes. I don't know. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Every single day of my life, I knew that I was morbidly obese, fatter than anybody in the city of Chicago. And yet every single day, with those little pecan pies, with those Twinkies, with the Hostess Susie Q's and cupcakes and pizza and God knows what, I beat myself on the head to try to get rid of that headache. I was doing it, but I didn't realize that I was doing it. I was absolutely beating myself on the head because of my headache with the very thing that had caused my problem. I ate railroad cars full of Chips Ahoy cookies to kill the pain of eating railroad cars full of Chips Ahoy cookies. Midway through 23, once in a while, he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. I was as baffled as anybody else. And for years, decades of my life, people would ask me, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And I couldn't come up with an answer. This disease killed my dreams. It killed my chances at a normal life. It beat me down and then it set me on fire. It destroyed me. I saw people and they looked happy and I wasn't. I wanted to be like them. I wanted to be anybody other than who I was. I wanted to hold a girl's hand before I died. I wanted to go on a date with a girl. I wanted to know what it was like to love and be loved. I wanted to know what it was like to look like a human being. I wanted to know what it was like to be part of the world. I don't know that I got there, but I feel more a part of it than I ever have. I don't know how others perceive me, but I do know that I perceive myself for the only time as a human being. I am part of life at last, and it is only by the grace of God and the fellowship of this program that I can wake up in the morning and not hate myself. It is only because of the grace of God and the fellowship of this program that I too can say, I am part of life at last. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. That describes me perfectly. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. I thought I'd beat the game when maybe I reached a certain age. I thought I'd beat the game if I had money. I thought I'd beat the game if I had a girlfriend. I thought I'd beat the game, whatever. But I knew in my mind I just needed to die because I was never going to beat the game. I just never saw that I could beat the game. I never could see it. How true this is, 20, page 23. How true this is, few realize in a vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal, but everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will. A lot of my friends think I just got smart, now I'm not fat anymore. They don't understand, and it isn't for them to understand. The only one that has to understand is me. Bottom of 23. The tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic. He passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. The tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. I remember having tears in my eyes. I remember crying myself to sleep many times, many, many times, because I just couldn't live. And the older I got, the more life got away from me. And my friends were out dating and getting married, and they were living their lives. They were doing what it was. They weren't sitting there waiting for me. And I couldn't believe that they were off into their lives when I couldn't join them. Because when we were kids and we were walking someplace, I could always say, "Hey, wait up." And they would. Now they won't. They were falling in love and they were starting businesses and they were doing the things that people do in their lives and they wouldn't wait up. They wouldn't wait up. And so I became even more defeated. Last paragraph of the day. It's in italics. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. I love it when people say food was my drug of choice. Wasn't my drug of choice, it was my drug of no choice. Whiskey is a drug of choice for me. I can choose to drink it or not. I don't care. Cocaine is a drug of choice for me. I don't choose to use it. Food? No, it chooses me. I don't choose it. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. No, practically for me, non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. This is talking about the mental blank spot. And the mental blank spot is that built-in forgetter where I can stand there in size 74-inch pants. And I've pissed in my pants. And I've shit in my pants. And I'm standing there deciding whether I should get the Chips Ahoy or I should get some other form of cookie like a Malamar or something else, because this time it's going to be okay. This time it's going to be okay. No, it's not. No, it's not. And that mental blank spot is where we're going to pick up our discussion next week. We are going to have a discussion about the sidekick of the mental twist, the mental blank spot, next week. And we're going to talk about what happens in the brain that causes us to forget the nightmarish horror when I eat food. And I'm going to talk about an experience I had when I was not even quite 2 years old, and I stuck my hand in a candle and burned myself. We're going to talk about that next week. But I'm going to jot down where we are. And before I turn this over, I just want to remind you guys that if you're asking questions, it's okay to ask if you asked last week, but please wait for a lull in the action. And no food questions. Let's not waste our time with food questions. Let me just write this down. And no math questions. No math and no food questions. And we'll get along just fine. Okay. I'm going to turn this over to, I don't know who. I'm going to turn it over to Maria since I don't remember. I'm going to turn
Okay.
it back over to Maria.
Thanks a million, Harlan. That was great.
She's great.
As always, Harlan, we're going to actually go over to Dottie. Dottie is going to host our Q&A today.